welcome to post-show recaps coverage of Shining Girls, the new Apple TV show starring Elizabeth Moss. My name is Grace. I'm very excited to be here, and I have stolen Josh Wigler's Severance crew to chat about a show that I did not realize would be as much like brain stuff as I thought, so I'm very excited to dig in. Melissa and Amanda, how are you doing? Melissa, how are you doing?
Good. My preview is that I messaged Amanda this morning saying, Amanda and Grace, that I had a very specific beef with this show that I was curious if Amanda would pick up on, and she picked up on it instantly. So we'll get to that when we get to it. But otherwise, yeah, we've got a fun new show to talk about.
Yeah,
we all were frustrated with the annoying medical terms that they were that Iris was throwing out.
The brain scientists have officially brain melded now, and Melissa and I are, I think, sharing a brain. I'm really, really happy to be back with Melissa podcasting another show and being joined by Grace. I think that this is, we are, you know, a force to be reckoned with here.
Yes. I've been saying on a lot of shows recently that, like, I feel very bad when I'm like watching a very dark show, like serious kind of, and I'm like, this is so fun, but, and this might be the epitome of it. Boy, does Elizabeth Moss know how to play a very sad, troubled, you know, tortured individual. And we get another one with Shining Girls on Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. None of us know much about this show going into it. None of us have read the books, right? That's correct.
That is correct.
Yeah. So we're going in blind. I feel like the show was intentionally confusing, as will be the point as we'll go along. Mm-hmm. So I think there will be a lot of stuff to uncover. But first off, right off the bat, if you're joining us, I know a lot of folks here on Post Show Recaps will often say, like, you don't have to have watched the show to jump in. But I do think that it is important for us to give some content warnings if you are doing that. I think if you've watched the show, you might know what you're in for. But we will continue the discussion of what happens on the show. And there are some content warnings, some things that are troubling. So, this show deals with assault, particularly sexual assault and gender-based violence. So, we wanted to give that message up front that those are topics that we're going to be discussing as we go along. I believe we have some resources. Amanda, you have some American resources.
Yeah. So because of the sensitive nature of some of the topics touched on in the show, we wanted to provide resources for anybody who might be concerned about those things or dealing with those things. In the U.S., RAIN has a national assault hotline that's completely confidential, and they also have a lot of other resources on their website. So that's rainn.org is where you can find their website, and you can reach their 24-hour support line at 1-800-656-4673. So that's 1-800-656-4673. And Melissa, I think that you have some resources in Canada.
Yeah. So WAVA, it stands for Women Against Violence Against Women, but they've shortened it to WAVA because they're a support for survivors of sexualized violence for any person of marginalized gender. So, open to non-binary folk and trans women and cis women as well. So, their crisis line is actually available internationally. So although it's an organization based in Vancouver, Canada, so I'm very excited to shout them out. But their crisis line is 1-877-392-7583. 1-877-392-7583. And they have a 24/7 crisis line as well. And if you are interested in checking out these resources and in need of any sort of support, we encourage you to reach out. These topics are hard. Please take care of yourselves as you're watching this show and listening to this podcast. I don't think we're going to hold back from talking about it because, it's a very impactful part of this show, but also we want you all to take care of yourselves when you need to.
Yes. Appreciate that. And take care of yourself. Listen for, drop out, stop, pause the podcast, stop listening. That's fine.
It's okay. It's okay.
You won't hurt our feelings. We're very hardy folk.
Yeah. We'll see you in the next one, whatever it is. Let's big picture thoughts. So we watched the premiere. We have not watched past episode one. Mm-hmm. What do we think?
So Apple TV dropped the first three episodes in one night, and we decided that we wanted to cover them episode by episode to sort of experience the show that way for our listeners who might be experiencing it that way. So some of you might have binged the first three episodes, and while we're talking about stuff, you're going to think, okay, those idiots, they couldn't figure out what was going on. But it is, so this is based on a novel that was published in 2013 by Lauren Bukes. I'm not sure exactly how to say her name. I really didn't know much about it other than that, especially because I was cautioned by Josh Wigler and other people who have read the book. I know Jess Sterling read the book that like, this is very, very spoilable. Like if you Google something about this show, you could instantly be spoiled. And it does seem to have some sort of mystery thriller sci-fi element. So I had to go against all of my instincts as a podcaster and not extensively research everything available on a topic before I talked about it.
And we can't even get you on the Reddit train yet.
I know.
We only do it after we record episode three, I feel like. I mean,
I was trying to figure out how many episodes there were. And I was like, Shining Girls, how many episodes? Yeah. And I was like, very careful not to scroll down.
Yeah. I love so when you have to like close one eye and be like holding your hand up against the screen to make sure that you don't see everything you're supposed to see.
So this is like a different kind of podcasting for me for that reason. As Melissa knows, like I think we share in common that we, if anything, over prepare about any topic that we're asked to talk about. But this is, I mean, so I mean, first of all, I'm immediately compelled by Elizabeth Moss's performance. You know, it's been pointed out that this seems to be a little bit of a niche of hers in her career, but like the way that she can communicate emotion and terror and ambivalence and fear. Like she just has this incredibly expressive style, and she was riveting to watch. So that was one of my initial impressions. And my other initial impression was WTF is going on. Like it's like it's quite confusing.
I mean, one of the things I'm most interested about is that I was expecting us to be able to dive into the mystery of this show. And I did know that the bad guy had been cast. I read a recap, so I know his name, but we do not get his name in episode one.
Right.
But this is not a show where we'd be trying to figure out who is the bad guy. We're trying to figure out, like, how is the bad guy so and then I think with whatever's happening with Kirby reclaiming the name Kirby from that little blue devil, so I'm excited for that. A cool name she's picked out for herself. And Melissa, you can choose any name you want in the world.
Yeah, it's really important to know that you can have any name you want in space and on television shows. It's great.
A recurring theme in our Dungeons and Dragons in space game is that we tell people every NPC we meet, you can be whatever name you want. You can choose whatever name you want. Be whoever you want to be.
Our DM loves it. No complaints.
But Melissa, with what's going on with Kirby, I don't know. I immediately was like, I'm excited to chat with the brain people about what is this? Is this time travel? Is this trauma response? What is going on with Kirby?
Yeah, and I think that that was the confusing part for me, is that I was very ready to dive into this show and be like, oh, this is her. Like, is there some sort of post-traumatic stress, dissociative identity, like what is going on here in response to this trauma that she's clearly experienced? And I was very ready to kind of rationalize it in a real world context, but I don't know if we're supposed to be doing that. Like, I don't know if there's more going on here that doesn't totally make sense. And I will say, like, while having just, I will not constantly compare the show to Severance, but there was, you know, in that
show, how could
show,
we not?
Yeah, it did feel like there were moments in that show where it felt like someone had done their homework, and it allowed more of that buy-in of like, okay, so this real world brain process that could be explaining what's going on here. This show, they have clearly not done their homework for some very basic things. And so I'm sorry, it's going to bug me, but
hey, we're not always going to be positive. We were going to recap shows. We're jumping in this totally blind. We're not always going to be super positive about everything.
We have enraged Melissa with misusing medical terms here.
But it makes me wonder then, like, okay, so maybe that's not where we're supposed to be giving our energy and our attention, right? Clearly there is some outside thing here. I'm just going to get into it right now. Lateral and medial don't mean up and down and across. Lateral means outside. Medial means towards the middle. So when he said, when she says, is it lateral or medial? That should mean like, oh, is it more towards the outside of your body or more towards the inside? Also, anterior means front. So when she says it starts in the anterior, yeah, because it was the front of her body. It's all anterior. They didn't carve up her back or her butt. Like that's not, anyway. There are actual terms. If you look up those terms, the definitions of those terms are like right there. It's not that hard.
But horizontal and vertical did not sound medically enough. Yeah.
But there are words for those. There are words for up and down and across.
Iris doesn't even exist.
Don't blame Iris. So yeah. So, I mean, this is a good point. I think like Melissa, I was trying to see signs of, you know, so obviously this show, we give this content warning that's going to deal with assault and violence. And, you know, Elizabeth Moss is playing the character of Kirby and she's processing the aftermath of her assault. So I think that we're going to see, I mean, this show is going to deal with the topic of trauma and she's having strange perceptual experiences, her experience of reality is, you know, is not stable. We as the audience are having trouble understanding, like, you know, what is the truth? Is there an objective truth of her reality? Does she live with her mom? Does she live with her boyfriend? Which apartment does she live in? What's her desk? Like, none of these things are clear right now from her perspective. So like Melissa said, is this going to be something like that we can recognize as a clinical phenomenon in the real world, like PTSD or dissociative identity disorder or fugue states? It might not map one-to-one onto those things, but I definitely think that whatever is happening with Kirby's experience of the world is going to, at least on a metaphorical level, speak to how somebody reacts to trauma. So I do think that there is some interesting, you know, truth that we can bring to bear in understanding that, even if it does seem like perhaps the show is going to be offering perhaps more supernatural explanations for what Kirby is experiencing. I think that they'll at least map on in a metaphorical way to what we can recognize as being reactions to trauma.
Yeah, that's my takeaway from the episode was I want to figure out, is this a condition that she's suffering from that is causing her to forget, parts of her consciousness, or as I think I believe I said on the Severance Feedback Show, that there is a type of media that is very popular at the moment, which is multiverse. The multiverse, very hot right now, so hot right now, everything everywhere all at once. So there's a Doctor Strange movie coming out, a Russian Doll multiverse stuff. Is this like time travel shenanigans that is causing her to experience, you know, when she, you know, there's a different multiverse where she lives with Marcus versus living with her mom. And what is the answer? I'm not sure. So we've only watched one episode. Let's dive into it. We open up on who we will find out later is Kirby sitting on a porch as a young girl. She's made sort of this homemade carnival. It's very cute. And then this creepy man, Jamie Bell, shows up. He's like, do you mind? And like, my knee locks up after it rains. She's like, it didn't rain. He's like, no, not here. Not yet. You're so creepy.
This line was interesting, though. Like, it certainly feels like we are dealing with some sort of time shenanigans where he talks. And then
not
later,
who is the bad guy, it's when.
I love it. Actually, that is a main thesis of the show Dark, which if you're listening to a Grace show, you can check off references Dark on the bingo card because I do it a lot. But that is a big, like, not where is Mikael, when is Mikael?
And, you know, later we'll have this conversation with Ginny where she doesn't know who he is. And he's like, oh, you don't know this time. Like, this definitely feels like a bit of a theme we're going to deal with.
Right. And this opening scene on the stoop with young Kirby is in 1966. And at this point, she looks to be, I don't know, maybe around 8 to 10 years old. And we're introduced to...
Actually, on poster recaps, you're going to need to tell whether she's a small, a medium, or a large.
What size garbage can is she?
I might have too much experience with actual children to podcast on poster.
This is me too. They're the same thing. I'm like the child. I'm like, no, they're like, I'll tell you what age they are. They're not inherently evil, you know?
We have a medium size traumatized juvenile human here. So the one thing I did do is I went on the IMDb because I wanted to make sure I got characters' names right. So I do know that the bad guy's name is Harper.
Harper, yeah.
Even though we're not told that in this episode. And, you know, he's going to look the same age as we're going to see him again in 1992, which is another clue that there's some time shenanigans going on. But one of the things he's going to do as he's, you know, creepy stranger talking to a little girl is he's, you know, admiring her little circus that she made, and she's captured a bee. The fun is this a funny bee, Melissa?
No, the funny bees.
This isn't a funny bee. This is a sad bee because he takes the bee, like, so she has it trapped under a cup. She's pretending that that's the lion in the circus.
No, the tiger, right?
He asks if it's a tiger, and she corrects.
She says
him.
It's a lion.
The lion. Got it. And she lets it, and he lets it out and grabs it with his hand, like does like a very like. I don't know, like I was thinking of like the Karate Kid, like capturing it with the chopsticks. And then he plucks the wings off of this bee. And he says, like, and this is a couple of times he makes comments like this. At first we find his shine, and then we take it away. Yep. And rips the wings off of this bee. And then we see the saddest little wingless bumblebee you ever did see.
So sad. He then gives her a Pegasus, which, Melissa, did you get this? Does he call it Philly?
So a filly is a female, like a young female horse.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I come from the horse capital of Canada, so I know that. But yeah, so that is funny.
I had no idea Vancouver was the horse capital.
Yeah, me neither.
Well, I'm not originally from Vancouver, but
yeah. It's are you from Alberta? The horse capital has to be in Alberta, right?
No, it's in British Columbia.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway. But yeah, so a filly is a young female horse. Or like a foal is the male. I believe horse people don't come for me if I'm mixing this up. It's been a long time. But I did work at a stable one summer for no money because I just wanted to be around horses. I'm sure
well, at least you had job stability,
people.
Right? Stable job.
Anyway, and he says, now a filly doesn't draw a crowd, but she's easier to break, which is just like,
very creepy.
He says, you'll take it. You always do. Which again was like another, like, what is going on with time? I don't know.
Time. Yeah. What a concept. she does take it. She goes to leave, but she does come back and grab the Pegasus. And we get the opening montage, and then we're in 1992. So we're jumping forward in time.
I just wrote down random nouns.
I'd love to hear some random nouns.
I was like, there's so much happening here, and I don't know if any of it is important. We've been told not to pay too much attention to the credits, but you never know. So I wrote newspaper, public transit, locks, stairs, horse, Swiss Army knife.
That does sound important.
I mean, the reference
this is,
everything
what is
again.
This man woman camera?
The creator of Step Right said that the team that did the animation for the opening had seen the whole thing, but I think almost everything you've mentioned is from episode one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we know Dan worked for a newspaper. We see she has a switchblade later. It's a lot of stuff that gets the Pegasus, the horse, not the exact same, but
you keep calling it a Pegasus. Were
there is
wings?
It a Pegasus?
There were wings.
Were there wings? Okay. There I missed wings. The wings.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay.
Yeah. So this takes place in Chicago.
Chicago.
You are like immediately smacked in the face of like,
Chicago,
by the way,
Chicago fire truck. Chicago
is a character. Is a character. It's 1992 and we're in grown up Kirby's apartment. She's in her room and she's writing strange notes in her diary. So it's pipe leaks, Godzilla mug, live with Rachel. And then we see that a cat jumps on the bed and she pets it and looks at the colander, the collar, and she writes down one cat named Grendel. So it seems like she's cataloging these facts, much like Melissa did with the credits there.
It was also like, sit next to Susan. So she's explaining her like work desk, right? Which we will then later see is going to be the wrong one. There's another, I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing, I think it's very, she goes back and forth, like, very, that she's living with her mom, but she's also calling her Rachel, is of note to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't often call my mom Nora, mm-hmm. at least not, like, to her face. So I'm wondering what's up there. She's packing. She's, you know, she's going to move to Florida. Her cousin has some space, so her mom is packing some boxes for her. So we know that she's, you know, looking for some change in her life. Yeah, she heads to work. We see the Godzilla mug. She's very organized, neat and organized. I like that everything is in its place, presumably because not everything is always in its place. So she's trying mm-hmm. to maintain some order. Yeah, we find out her last day is Friday. So she works at this sort of in the basement, making copies, filing papers right. for the newspaper.
I think she's in the newspaper right. archives there. I do want to note that that Kirby's mom, Rachel, seems to be a rock band. And when yes. In the kitchen, when she asks if they went on last night, she said, no, Jesus Lizard went long. And Jesus Lizard is a popular, you know, hardcore noise rock band that was based in Chicago in the late 80s, early, like mid through the 90s. So like that was so I mean, she must be, I guess that she's getting bumped by Jesus Lizard, so she can't be that accomplished, but she's playing in clubs with Jesus Lizard. So maybe she's, you know, something of note.
Some people might recognize her. She was in The Leftovers. She plays Laura Garvey in The Leftovers.
Yes.
Lots of connection. I just couldn't help but think she looks so much like Courtney Cox in this. I don't know why. Yeah.
I thought the same thing. And then I looked her up and realized she was from The Leftovers and said, okay, no, she looks more like that woman. But
my main hangup was the age difference here.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that is purposeful, like, oh, time is weird, who knows, or if it's like women expire after 40 and like we can't, you know, cast someone age appropriate to be Elizabeth Moss's mom.
So if we go from 1966 to 1992, that's about 26 years. So we think that that Kirby's probably in her mid to late 30s, I would guess, here. And her mother does not look like she can be more than like, you know, maybe 20 years older than her at the absolute most. So maybe it was a young, maybe we think she was a young mom, that could check out, but,
Do the real age, Amy Brenham at 57, Elizabeth Moss 39. So she could have had her when she was 18 and the math works. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Young mom.
There's a flood and someone is running. He's taking his shoes off. It's good. Don't get them wet. We later learn this is Dan Velasquez. And he goes underground and he's like noticing that nobody is wearing hard hats. He gets stopped by this man. He's like, yeah, it was a state of emergency, and he's like, well, the pipe is clear for the first time in 50 years. Like, what'd you find in there? Tell me.
Anything good. Yeah.
Anything good. And, the guy won't give him the details, but, so Dan gives him his business card. Let me know if you find anything.
Yeah. And I think that we can discern that this is probably like the chief of police or something, that this is somebody high up in precinct 26 or whatever they'll refer to it later, but he seems to be, affiliated with the police.
Yeah. And then as they're leaving, we hear them say, careful with her leg. We're ready to move her out now.
Dan Velasquez played, I know him from Narcos. He played, oh my gosh, what's the main guy's?
Pablo Escobar.
Pablo Escobar. Yeah. Wagner Mora.
I didn't watch Narcos, but I knew that he was famous from that. And obviously Pablo Escobar is a very different character than this intrepid reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. But I enjoyed him in this episode. I thought he was quite good.
Me too. I think he's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kirby comes back from lunch and somebody is sitting at her desk. There's a different mug on the desk. And this guy's like, what are you talking about? Your desk is over there. So something is up.
Yeah. Always has been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is our first sign that, because we very much saw Kirby at that desk in that corner of the room with the leaky pipe and the Godzilla mug, in a previous scene. But now we learn that her desk has always been on the other side of the room. So this is our first kind of indication that this point of view that we're getting from Kirby's character might not be reliable.
Yeah. And she keeps getting a call. She's had about 5 missed calls from somebody, I believe his name is Sean Linsky. We'll meet him a little bit later. Yeah. Dan is meeting with, I believe, like the editor, and they're like, yeah, we'll put some resources onto this case. And Dan really wants to work on it. And she's like, you know, you got to finish your own story first. Like, you're just back from leave, like, take it slow. So, you know, something's up with Dan. And this is when somebody comes in and is like, hey, you, this guy, Ronnie Birdie. Samuels, this is Birdie. Yeah. Yeah.
Birdie comes in.
Yeah. Like, hey, like Ronnie Samuels, you're pretty hot on him, you know? Dan reveals that it's Julia Madrigal who was found in the pipes, who went missing 2 years ago. Birdie has been taking on some of the load of Dan's case. So they're going to give it to Birdie. It's like, let me do some legwork on it. And Dan's like, no, I would like to do it. I love this line. He's like, you know, they're like, people really like Birdie. And Dan, like, almost hyping himself, like, people like me.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that Abby says is that Birdie's been making inroads with the police. Like, you know, so this is like, I mean, this is this big issue of like, you know, access journalism, like how contentious can the press be with their sources? And so sources like, you know, government officials and police officers, like you end up having to be like friendly with them. So Birdie's been making inroads with the police. Later, we're going to see Dan and this police chief meet, and they're not on as friendly terms. So it's like maybe Dan is ruffling a few more feathers along the way than Birdie has been.
That guy's a real jerk to Dan though later, I gotta say. I mean, he's like, yep. You know.
But, oh yeah. Yeah, agree. We're on Team Dan, clearly.
Team Dan all the way. Yes. Yeah. So we do end up meeting the Sean Linsky. I was a little bit confused. He's asking about her name. It seems like maybe like he had a relationship with Rachel is the implication. Like yeah, he even called in 6 years or something. Is it her dad? I couldn't.
No, I think my read is that this was a detective that had her assault case and they didn't find anybody. So I think that like there was probably a lot of hurt feelings from her side as the victim, and that she changed her name either that was what was recommended from the police or that was her choice. And so I think that he says like, you know, I tried calling you and your mom, you know, wasn't returning the calls. And I think it was like, it's been 6 years was like, yeah, it's been 6 years and you haven't done anything. My attacker is still loose. That was kind of my reading of this.
Yeah, so I definitely thought this was her dad at first too. Yeah. And then like as we see the rest of it, I came to the same conclusion that Amanda did, that this was the detective from her case that she'll mention later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely confusing, especially when I was like, where are they? Oh, they're in a courthouse. Like, okay, what's happening here? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the exchange about the name is interesting. So like her last name that she chose is Mizrachi, is that what it is?
Yeah.
He's like, how'd you come up with that? And she says that it's a National Geographic photographer. And then he says, well, what about Kirby? And she's like, I don't know, just having fun.
Yeah, sounded fun.
Actually, the photographer piece is interesting when we'll meet Marcus later. I didn't pick up on that connection, but that's interesting. Yeah, so Linsky has found some similarities between her assault and this Julia murder. Says we have a suspect, and he's asking her to pick out somebody, you know, photos of different men if she can pick him out. She gets a little bit flustered. She does not remember what he looks like. This is for Lyons very point. It's like he's everybody, he's nobody, he's all the effing time. Mm-hmm. And he says, "You don't remember anything about him?" He's like, "Yeah, I remember what he sounded like when he called me a whore." So
yeah.
Not great.
Yeah, that was a really powerful scene. And this is like the first, I think, explicit mention that we learned that she's experienced this assault.
Yeah.
And I think, too, the trauma here of like her response of like, you know, he could be the person bagging my milk. He could be the person behind me at the store. He could be like holding the door, like holding the door. Like, it's just like how trauma, like, yeah, it's just like, you know, you have anxiety of paranoia after you've been assaulted. It's
there's some like at one point he like shows the list and then he tries to like narrow down the suspect pool for it. Like there's a lot of really interesting psychology research around memory and how malleable it is. Basically, the idea is that like every time you recall a memory, it gets re-implanted. And so it's really easy if you recall a memory and kind of add some suggestion to it that suddenly it's like, oh yeah, that car was blue the whole time. Like I remember that now, even if it was new information provided after the fact. There's a lot of So this just like made me think of all of that. Like, who knows how reliable her recounting of this is anymore after 6 years of telling this story over and over again.
And specifically, a lot of this research has been on eyewitness testimony and how unreliable that is. And like, and, you know, and even like the, so the unreliability of confessions and like identifying like Melissa said, it's like, you know, just the act of looking at these faces on the photo lineup is going to create a new memory that could interfere with the actual like you know, appearance of the assailant. So those are really good points. You know, I think that this line that you pointed out, Grace, is being poignant, you know, he's everybody, he's nobody, he's all the effing time, is like going to be really like central to whatever her experience is, because like when she can't, I mean, this is one of the reasons that trauma has such an impact, is like one of the, like our ability to make sense and understand and develop a coherent narrative around things that happen to us is like very important psychologically for us to feel safe. And when you have one of these experiences and you can't even identify, you know, who did this to you and why and where, like all of those questions for her are creating this like sense of being very unmoored, which is really anxiety provoking and scary. So I think her experience of her desk moving and, you know, all of these other things in her reality shifting sort of gets at this idea that because she can't make sense of this trauma, she can't make sense of these other things in her life.
Yeah. So she heads home after this and she sort of just heads right to her room. Although we hear Rachel seemingly showing the room to someone. She had said earlier that, like, you know, she can't afford to keep this place on her own. She'll have to like rent out the room once Kirby is gone. And I did notice this when she lies on the bed, you do see the Pegasus on the nightstand. So our first indication that this is, you know, this officially is it was Kirby in the in the flashback at the beginning. We see this, so she falls asleep. We see this random house, we hear banging and, it's our, you know, Harper, breaking down, the door. Kirby wakes up to hear pounding at her door and a dog comes in. She checks the collar and it's Grendel. So she writes in her notebook, dog Grendel.
Grazzo cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, we definitely get kind of very fixed on the door when she goes in, that this is apartment 2B, because that will also be relevant later.
Yes. So we meet Ginny, who I, somebody in the Discord pointed out, is from Hamilton.
Philippa Sue is the actress, and she was, she starred in Hamilton. So this is Ginny, and she seems to be an astronomer working at the planetarium. We follow her to work.
Yep. We see this man giving a presentation to the kids. It feels like the worst presentation.
Yeah, those kids, those poor kids.
Yeah.
They're at the planetarium. The planetarium's so cool. Like they're making it so boring.
Yeah. He's like, why don't you know, there's telescopes upstairs. And so they're all very excited. And they head out. And he's like, you know, they're not going to be able to see anything in the rain. It's like, well, just let them, you know, maybe one of them will be inspired. She then spots a bumblebee on her desk. It has no wings. She chucks into the garbage. This man is like, hey, they carry messages from the heavens, according to the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah, her like her poor like this bumbling like fellow astronomer, her colleague. It's like he seems well intentioned, but she's like kind of not interested in him. Yeah, but another bee, they carry messages from the heavens. But she's like, not this one. He doesn't have any wings. He's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I kept waiting for this guy to like be like the secret bad guy or something. I don't know. He's just very weird. And she just doesn't seem to be interested in like getting him the time of day at all. Yeah. And I was like, oh, what's this history? Like, what's going on here? Who is this guy? Why does he seem like overly eager to help? Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe he has a crush. I don't know. I had some sympathy for this character.
Yeah, maybe she's his boss and he's trying to like suck up to her or something. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. So we end up in a bar. Dan is meeting up with this guy Samuels, who we saw earlier, and he has a suspect, Pavel Banik. And says, what's the connection? Well, he was one of her patients, Julia's patient. She was a social worker. And immediately Dan is like, you know, did he have a lawyer at the time you spoke to him the first time? They're like, no,
yeah,
lawyer present. And Dan's immediately like, wow, okay, so you're trying to railroad a mentally ill man, and now you want me to accuse him of murder. So it seems like the idea here is that the police have an old suspect who they did suspect him in the previous case, but they are just kind of like hoping to find a suspect that they think could fit the crime, perhaps without enough evidence.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So I did look up this code because, you know, you have to do like a little bit of homework. They say Julia typically worked with 1096,
yeah,
which is a mental subject. So, probably a lot of adults with some sort of mental health concern there. So Dan, I think immediately is kind of understanding the context of this situation that maybe, we're talking about eyewitness testimony being really fallible. Confessions can also be really, you know, can be given under kind of stressful situations.
Oliver did a great segment on this, I think not that many weeks ago, probably two weeks ago or so, that's all about how unreliable confessions are, and that like people, you just think that like, yeah, how could anybody ever admit to something? And they just walk through how like how police have been trained to basically
be able
to figure out how to unlock that mechanism in people to like admit to stuff that they didn't do.
And Dan like totally locks in on it. You railroaded a mentally ill man, you violated his Miranda rights. And, you know, and the, you know, a cop being unscrupulous, never, we doubt it.
Yeah.
But now all of a sudden the tone is much less friendly. And he says, you know, my wife used to read you, but then, you know, your column disappeared. We thought you retired. And he's like, and I looked you up and you had a domestic write-up and possession, You know, Dan says like, well, he's in treatment now. And he's like, yeah, how's that going for you? Meet me at the McDonald's next time.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting. So, you know, class A possession is referring to kind of controlled drugs under this like restricted classification. So, you know, this could be anything from, you know, cocaine, heroin, marijuana, like alcohol is not a class A drug.
No.
So, you know, this is maybe a bit judgy, police officer, whatever, but also, I don't know. It was just interesting. This like combination of things did make me sort of wonder about Dan and like, okay, maybe we don't like instantly just like trust him implicitly. Like if there is some sort of domestic, violence in his past, like, I don't know. That part of it did make me a little bit.
We don't know enough about Dan yet.
The domestic stuff makes me nervous, especially somebody who seemingly so far is, someone that it does seem like we're supposed to root for. I think this is the first step. But like, yeah, I think the way that this scene is set up, though, is supposed to be like Samuels is a bit of a jerk. Like he, this guy, he's like, you know, but then also, yeah, if he has a domestic, right. I'm just a little nervous of like in 2022 to be like, the domestic, like, it was not what it was made out to be. You know, I'm just like a little nervous about going down this path in modern times, but maybe the show can surprise me and it's not what I'm expecting at the moment. So, yeah. Basically Dan's like, yeah, I'm not going to sell a case you couldn't make 2 years ago. Kirby's reading about Julia. She has all these like some of the newspaper articles printed out on her desk. Marcus comes up. He's Marcus. He sort of scares her while she's listening to headphones. He listens into the music and he's like, yeah, it's different. It's cool. It's cool.
And yeah, they're all flirty. It's cute.
They're flirty.
Yeah. No, they seem sweet. And she tells him that she liked his outtakes. You know, he's a photographer for the paper. And then he takes a picture of her and she's like all, you know, aw shucks, smiley, shy. And he's like, I needed to finish the role. I got a good one of you in here. So that's very sweet.
Yeah. Very cute. This woman comes up and is like, oh, like you pulled all these articles for Dan. And Dan's like, conveniently right there. And he's like, I didn't ask you to pull anything. He's like, you pull these for Birdie? And she's like, yeah, which is that's a lie. don't say that. And Dan's upset because he believes that like Birdie is sort of stealing the story out from under him. Yeah. Upset. Someone is poaching his story. So, yeah. Ginny goes out up on the roof to have a smoke, and the door closes behind her. Is very worried in this moment. She's locked out, but she conveniently finds an umbrella and opens it up just as it starts to rain.
So I don't think it's just any umbrella. I think this is her umbrella, because I think it's the same one that we see at the very beginning when we're introduced to her when she's walking into the planetarium.
Yeah.
That's a good catch, yeah.
And I'm very like focused on color in these shows, and I think that the red umbrella and then the red light that we'll see in with the telescope later on is certainly connected. So yeah, it's creepy. I didn't like it.
It's scary. After it rained, right? That's to me, that was the biggest thing.
It didn't rain. Oh, it didn't rain here. So interesting. Very interesting.
Kirby is watching Dan. She's like handing out copy. And then she steals his notepad. Bold move. She sees the name Pavel Banik. So she heads to his house. Bold move again.
I wrote down all the notes. Grace is on a podcast with Amanda and I. We paused it and wrote down all the notes. So it says, in kind of shorthand, evidence points to premeditated murder, victim discovered in the culvert tunnel under City Hall, likely killed at separate location, abrasions consistent with dragging, and then a drawing of the body with kind of what we'll see is the cut later, concussive hemorrhaging, incised wound, abdomen, adiposear, no evidence of drowning, which is kind of this like waxy kind of thing that can happen to fat later, so that's they've kind of ruled that out. Victim is a social worker, client of hers, brought in for questioning when missing, confessed but didn't charge. 1096, no lawyer present. Julia Madrigal, subject Pavel Danik, 928 North Smythe Road.
Checks out, Melissa.
So she's gonna head there. She's gonna head to the address that you just said and wrote down that I definitely didn't. She gets greeted by this woman, presume maybe his mother, and is like, all you police officers, like, I can't make you any more tea.
I can't make more tea.
Love this woman. Like, and she has like a thick Polish accent. I guess the newspaper's been there all day. So Kirby's gonna say, can you send Palik outside, and she says like, no, come inside, invites her in, directs her to where Powell is, and here we see that Kirby has a knife on her, and she's going to walk through the hall into the dark room where the woman had directed her, and then we hear Powell's in there in the dark. We can't really see him. He tells her to be quiet and says, you know, we see that the TV is on static, and says she likes the fuzzy sound of the TV. And in this scene, like, Elizabeth Moss is just like portraying pure terror, and she's, you know, and rage simultaneously. And she says, you know, who likes it? Julia. And he's like, I did not hurt Julia. I only knew her for 5 months. And this is when we think Kirby realizes that this is not the voice that she remembers, which is the only thing that she claims to have a clear memory of her attacker. She's like, why are you talking like that? Your voice, it's not. And then we hear a baby crying, and she realizes that they're in the dark because he's putting his baby to sleep, and she's woken up this baby, and this isn't her attacker. So she sort of panics and leaves and says, I'm sorry, and runs outside.
Yeah. This is like, yeah, this is like the stuff that they've cast Elizabeth Moss for, right? The show, of this, like, yeah, you're right. You said, like, yeah, it's terror and rage and confusion.
Yeah.
All at once. You can like emote everything, every emotion everywhere all at once. Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a quick commercial break. We come back, we'll chat through the rest of the episode. Okay. Kirby runs outside and immediately runs into Dan. And so they head to a diner, and he's like, what happened in the house? And she's saying he was just putting his kid to bed, and it's like, who sent you over there? Like, if you're trying to get on the desk, this is not the way to do it. And it's like, I'm already leaving, you can't fire me.
he's like, are you trying to get promoted? And she's like, don't fire me.
I'm kidding.
I love this where he's like, oh, did Birdie, like, she's, yeah. you said you were helping Birdie with the story. And she says, I never said I was, you did, which I thought was like, oh.
Yeah, she's good. It's like, I'm moving to Florida. It's like, what's there? Just a cousin with a couch and change. And she says, I'm not trying to take your story. And this is where Dan hones in that, like, is it personal? She thought she knew Pavel, but she doesn't. And this is where she admits that the detective on the case believed that there were similarities between Julia's murder and her own assault, which happened 6 years ago. And he says, yeah, okay, I guess I get why you want change. And Dan is asking why the detective thought it was the same guy. She explains that she was cut up in the same way Julia was. And but Pavel didn't have the same voice, so it was not him. And Dan asks, well, what were you going to do if it was him?
So, and we get an immediate cut, so we don't even give an opportunity for her to answer that.
No,
I did like this line that he gets why she wants to change, but she picked the one city in Florida without a beach.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, if you're moving to Florida, don't make it Orlando.
Yeah, find a beach. Yeah. So, I mean, this is our first, like, we've seen Kirby and Dan sort of interact, but this is our first, like, okay, this is our show. I think this is the two of them teaming up on this case, I think is what our show will be moving forward. So I think they have good dynamic here. I think it's interesting. Yeah. So we see Ginny is working. The coworker asks, do you want to grab lunch? No answer.
She's like, nah. She's like, just holds up the sack. It's like,
yeah.
Kind of the original ghost. She doesn't even say anything.
Yeah. And then and the guy's like, well, I'll tell security about the roof door. And then she's like, no, don't even worry about it.
I should have my keys. No, all good. And she goes to watch this like video. I love these things. Have you either of you been to one of these like giant projectors?
Yeah, I love them. Planetarium. Yeah. So like she works in the planetarium, and I guess this is like how she likes to take her lunch. Just like go in. I love like because like you know the seats they have you reclining because you're looking at the, like the full surround. So you're looking up at the sky, and I like the move of just like having your sandwich there, like while you're reclining, just like popping the carrot sticks into your mouth.
I went to one a while ago that was like a like public talk about brain stuff. So it was all these like projected brain images. It was very cool.
Wow.
So yeah, check out your local planetarium. You know, they might have
closed up. Hopefully you don't have this guy Harper sitting at the bed. He walks up, sits behind her. He's like, good show. It's really good. She's like, yeah, well, I watch it once a week. And then I think on the Discord, I saw somebody being like, of course, this guy mansplains stars to the lady who worked at the planetarium.
Yeah. this was so enraging. Yeah, he tells her, he's like, yeah, it's pretty good, but they left some things out. The stars that you see, and then he says, the stars that you see are dead. The ones that are shining, they're exploding in on themselves. This is the second time that Harper says something creepy about Shining. The show is called Shining Girls. So I think this is a motif. And she says, well, that's only true for the most distant stars. The ones in our galaxies live on past us. She's a scientist, dude.
And he's still not convinced. He's all like, I don't know. And
it's not how she heard it.
She does know.
Yeah. I did my own research and about this.
Gosh, can you tell Amanda? He's
literally... Yeah, how relatable, right? Yeah.
And then he calls her Ginny, so he knows her name, and she's really caught off guard. And then he says, I thought I'd give you a minute, but you still don't recognize me. And she says, well, have you been on one of my tours? And he says, no. And then she's like, well, then I don't know you. I love this. She's like, I don't know you. And he laughs, you know, not today. I guess not.
Brutal. It's so creepy. I mean, we'll see what happens. I'm hoping that somehow, you know, we're playing with time, that there's more Ginny in this show. Again, people are like laughing at us if they've watched more. And like, of course she's in the rest of the show. I mean, it's such a bit, it feel like a big enough casting name to think that there's more to Ginny's story. But we shall see. We do not know yet.
Yeah, we saw her in the preview, like in the trailer. It definitely feels like it. I just wanted to, this was the part in my watch that I like. There was this moment, there's the moment at the very beginning. I just like, it was so freaking relatable. This moment of like talking to someone, feeling uncomfortable, and prioritizing not being rude in that moment Ooh. Versus your own comfort. Mm. And it was just like so like sinking in the gut of my stomach because I was just like, I've been there. Like, I know this moment so intimately well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of like a lot of people, specifically women, do.
Right.
And I just like, anyway, it was just this moment of I'm like, and like, this is gonna not go well for you. And it's just like, those alarm bells are going off and you're like, it's fine. It's not that big a deal. Like, he's just making conversation. I can be nice and then like get off to work. And it's anyway, it was just really hard to watch.
There were some nice subtle moments in this that I picked up on too. Like when he says, oh, do you like come here often or whatever, how he starts talking to her. And at first she just like kind of like smiles and doesn't even say anything. Like it's like she's mm-hmm. doing these mm-hmm. subtle things that are like, I am not engaging with
there
you.
Are signs, Harper. Read them.
and it's kind of even the same thing with her coworker, right? It's like she's giving like these signs, like, I don't want to engage with you. I'm just here to do my work. I just want to eat my sandwich. I just want to like, you know, go and it's so she's giving these very subtle signs, but without being rude and without being explicit. And it's clear that he's making her uncomfortable. So I thought that there were some, you know, like you said, Melissa, like really relatable and nice, like true to life. Subtle ways that both the writing and the performance got that across.
Yeah.
And I think like it, even
just even like Kirby with like the big headphones over, right? Like I switched from wearing like smaller headphones when I was on public transit to bigger, like obvious, because the number of times I've been like listening to something and someone tries to talk to me and they're like, oh, and I don't know you. I don't owe you my time and conversation right now. Like, leave me alone.
Yeah. And then I think that thing you said about like she's being so kind is like the thing that people expect of like, yeah, you have to be like kind and polite, even though like she's being bothered, you know, that like she shouldn't have to be, you know, polite in this moment. I guess like she works. But even then, I'm like the idea that like all service workers should always be like happy and smiling all the time. It's like, yeah, maybe their day sucks. I don't know.
That's her lunch break. She's not there in a professional capacity in that moment. She doesn't like owe anybody that interaction.
Yeah. Yes. So this is where this is Melissa's least favorite scene, when Dan takes Scurvy to the morgue to see Iris,
the medical examiner.
My least favorite scene until they screwed this up, just because I felt like Iris was being like really pushy and like not at all sensitive or kind in this moment.
I agree, but I think that like
this is why she's a medical examiner.
If you're a pathologist, if you're if all of your professional experience is working on corpses, like you don't have to develop that kind of bedside manner. Like she's not used to examining, you know, living people who can actually like be uncomfortable and not just let you poke and prod at them.
Yeah. And it's funny because we like meet Iris and the first thing she says is a joke about the dead bodies of like, don't worry, they can't get out. And I was like, oh, I love her. This is great. Like, I'm going to love this character. And then like everything after this, I was like, nope, I hate it.
Ah. And also I'm like, I don't know what Josh Wigo is very big on. Like, you got to let the show tell you what it is before you like, I don't know that the corpses won't wake up. I don't know that this isn't just happening. I don't know. Yeah. Could there be corpses? Could there be clones? We don't know.
Clones are very much on the table right now. I'll just say that.
There's dead bodies in the table around Iris. I also thought that I need shows. I don't know. It's like, you know, like when you're watching a show and like you're watching something, like you're watching a show from the 90s, you're like, wow, that's a lot of people hanging out in public, even though COVID is not a thing for like 30 years. Gosh, all the formaldehyde, they really want us to wear masks. And I'm like, stop, anti-masker joke in like the 2020 show.
Iris is an anti-masker. She says, she says that her memory's going from the formaldehyde and they're saying we have to wear masks. But after 40 years, why does it matter? And I'm like, it matters, Iris. It matters.
Yeah, we're watching this in 2022. Please don't make an anti-mask joke.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, she is asking her about her assault. She's asking about the scar tissue. Kirby is very hesitant. Like, again, this is all memories, you know, whether it's memory and also this like uncomfortableness of like being asked such direct questions about this thing that happened. And also, I think they do a good job here of her being like, you know, I did answer all this stuff before and it really didn't help, which I think is like a good, you know, a little line in here that's like, yeah, the, you know, we're talking about like, why people don't report things, you know, all of the stuff of like, yeah, because the justice system can sometimes not be very helpful to people.
I mean, and this is also where I was a little bit like, this is not great on Dan, because, you know, like Dan is sort of, I mean, Dan is sort of apparently like he knows at this point that Kirby obviously is very interested in learning more about who, in identifying her, you know, she wants to help with the case. She wants this guy to be brought to justice. So, you know, they're joining on that need, but like, this is obviously going to be an extremely sensitive thing for her to process. And when like, she's going to be like discussing her own experience and her own scars and wounds, you know, like just taking her to somebody who doesn't have like the clinical skills or training to actually talk to people about things. It's like there are doctors who are trained in evaluating people after this kind of event. And like somebody who mostly works on cadavers is not going to do that. And I felt like this was a situation where she was sort of pushed into something and she was expressing discomfort. And as soon as she started expressing discomfort, it should have sort of been like, okay, maybe this wasn't a great idea. So I felt like both Iris and Dan could have or should have known better.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. She kind of talks about it at some moments very like kind of rote, just like stating of the facts, which I thought was very interesting that like clearly she has had to tell this story numerous times over the last 6 years. And so it felt like she was like, yep, you know, classified aggravated assault because he had a knife. Like she's very, it felt like very rehearsed. And then there was kind of these moments of her being like, oh, well, I don't know. And you could feel the like hesitancy and then she would do it. I did think that obviously like the acting in this scene is wonderful, even if it made me upset.
So Iris is going to push, to actually do like an exam, like actually see, the wounds is very like, you know, ooh, the sheets are warm right out of the dryer. I was like, that's so, cause like my initial thought is like, those are, that means that they've been used for cadavers. I'm like, no, no. But she does get up on the table. This is, when she's doing the examination. And then sort of in an instant, it's not Iris anymore. It's Howard.
I have a couple beefs.
Okay.
How does a half inch difference tell her anything about his mindset? What does that even mean, Iris? That's not a thing. I'm not a medical professional, but I feel pretty confident that you can't tell someone's mindset from a half inch difference on a laceration. I thought that was weird.
So this is okay. That could be sloppy writing. I'm gonna say, like, personally, I've always had a lot of mixed feelings about medical legal interactions and like forensic medicine, and like I am in a field, clinical neuropsychology, where there is a branch of forensic neuropsychology. And obviously forensic psychologists have like evaluated people and made determinations about like their mental state and criminal intent and all of that. And I do think that these sort of forensic medical professionals are like, because of the pressures of that position to make determinations, they definitely overstep the bounds of what the science can tell us about things like, you know, mindset and intention. Like the problem is that legal concepts do not map on to medical concepts in a very clean way, but the legal system does not tolerate that type of ambiguity. So the people who end up succeeding very much in those fields are the people who are kind of willing to fudge that and make strong claims, because that's what plays really well in a courtroom. And like the police are going to come back and work with you if you write the kind of reports that are compelling to a jury, and not if you write the kind of reports that are saying like, well, this could mean this, or it could mean this, or there's a range of different, like that's not the kind of thing that plays with juries. So I do think that like again, like talking about, you know, scruples in the legal system, that like, I think that even if you can't know those things scientifically, a lot of people in these positions will claim to be able to know those things.
I was thinking initially that, like, I feel like the lens in which the show will have is from Kirby's perspective, but also, you know, Dan is like a journalist. So this is going to be like kind of, I think, a little bit of like a newspaper-y TV show of like investigative journalism. And so I wonder if that point you're making, I mean, I wonder how like intentional that is. I mean, the other thing too is this is supposed to be 1992. So how much has stuff changed over 30 years? Give me the 1992 is 30 years.
That can't be right. No.
Somebody had a newspaper had to issue a correction recently because something came out in the 90s and they were like 2 decades ago. And they're like, it's actually 3 decades ago. I know, it's so weird. But yeah, so 3 decades, you know, worth of like, you know, medical advancement. How much are they playing into, you know, what it was like at that time? But I wonder if that's like intentional to be like, yeah, this person's overstepping their bounds. Or in my estimation, I think this is like from the lens of newspaper investigative journalism and sort of advancing that story more so than perhaps anything else. But again, we don't know what the show is fully yet. So
yeah. And then the weirdest part is that part of her intestines were removed and he left something, or Kirby asks if he left something inside Julia. And it definitely kind of seems to be mentioned later that there was something left inside Kirby.
Yeah. I mean, and another point, like, you know, that this scene definitely underlines is like whatever she went through was horrific. Like what we learn, like the details that we learn from her explanation and seeing her exam and the questions that she asked make it clear that this was really, really, really terrible. And then she has this experience of while she's being examined, she looks up and instead of seeing, you know, kind older lady Iris, she sees Howard and completely panics, asks what happened to Iris. Nobody knows who Iris is. Dan doesn't know who Iris is. Howard doesn't know who Iris is. You look on the wall and where we used to see Iris's diplomas, now we see Howard's diplomas.
Dan's like, do you want me to call her?
Yeah, it's like, who's Iris? I'll call her.
Yeah.
And she's just like, why the F did you bring me here? And I was like, yeah, Dan, bad idea. This is a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So very complicated. I think that going back, we said, you know, this is not a show of who did this. It's how they did this. And I think now, you know, we're going to be diving into the why he's doing this. We gave, you know, sexual assault content warnings up front. And I know a lot of people who have like read some recaps of episode one where people are giving up those same content warnings. There's no implication so far that it's like, you know, sexual in nature, but like certainly he is doing something. We don't, you know, we will see the scene with Ginny later where like we don't get a ton out of that scene either, other than that he attacks her and does presumably stabs her, but we don't know like what is he, you know, this is I feel like it's very like Criminal Mindsy of like what is he getting out of tracking and then attacking these women, and then what is he doing when he attacks them, I think is like going to be a thing we're going to try to uncover as we go along as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that like this can still be gender-based violence without there being any sort of like explicit like kind of sexual assault.
Yes.
And so that definitely, you know, seems to be the case here, which is horrifying and also, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. So Kirby heads home. Rachel is singing. She's like, you need to be quiet or like they're going to call the super. There's a full set of china. She's like, it's the only full set I could find. You can take it when you move, although your cousin will probably steal it anyway. And this is where she's like, you know, you can stay. You don't have to move. And we get another, you know, Elizabeth Moss, you know, monologue here that like, presumably this type of stuff will be the stuff that's like, you know, Oscar, you know, Emmy nominated, you know, going to submit this for the reel. She's like, I can't stay here. After what he did to her, things aren't how they should be. Mom's like, you're still working through it. She's like, it's not like that. Everything is like always, then it's not. It starts with little things and then it's big things. And so I think this is, you know, obviously something that she's been, I think that's, we jump into the show, like she's writing in her notebook, clearly like things are changing and to the matter in which like how big things are changing seem to be big already. And yet she's still like very, I mean, I guess you would be, but it's not like she's like used to it by now, you know. It's still like, right. You know, when she returns to her desk, she's like, what are you doing? That's my desk, you know, rather than like, just like, yep, like, things are different again.
Desk moved again.
How annoying. Yeah. You know?
And it's interesting that it's not like missed time. Like, it's not like she's any sort of, you know, we mentioned like dissociative identity. Like, it's not like she's got blackout periods where she's kind of, something has changed and she missed the change. It's that like, no, it's always been this way. You just have this like totally different memory of it, which is interesting and makes it harder to understand, I think.
Yeah,
definitely.
But yeah.
Yeah. If there was lost time, then I think that we would be like examining some other possible like psychological mechanisms that are known, but because it's not, it seems like something different. But again, I'll say like, this is one of those comments that like what she says to her mother could be interpreted in a way that is like, you know, it like we have seen it appear much more supernatural than what she said, but what she said could still be something that you say to describe like a relatable psychological state in our world. Like everything's like it always was, and then it's not, things change, it's not how I left them, nothing is where it should be, and I don't recognize it anymore. Like that language could be used to describe something that is more sort of true to real life experience. So I think that that's going to be like an interesting place where we're trying to see like, how does whatever is happening in terms of this being more of like a supernatural time travel-y thriller thing map onto like illuminate what the actual experience is of living with trauma.
Yeah. Like you have a day that's like the exact same as every other day, but like, you're incredibly sad that, you know, or like, you know, it's like it's a rough day, but like, from the outside in, everything is the same, you know, I'm just going to work, I'm, you know, whatever. I think the way that like her mom is hearing it, I think you're right that it's not like, ooh, something's going on. It's just like, no, this is just like, you know, not regular, I guess. I mean, stuff that people go through. But yeah. So her mom brings up, you know, remember like Aunt Darlene's first husband, like he ran away after he gave her like two kids, and he ended up on like a, you know, some farm or whatever with
living on a commune in Oregon. Yeah.
Five kids. He left for peace and quiet, and he ended up with the exact same thing. And she's like, what is the point of this? It's like, you know, moving across the country is not going to get you something different. If you want to stop feeling this way, you better figure it out right here.
And I wondered this when she said the commune in Oregon. Did either of you watch Wild Wild Country on Netflix?
Yes.
Yeah. With the Ocho. Or yeah. Like, yeah. Oh. I was like, yeah. Oh, I bet I know where you went.
Yes, that's right. that would be, the time would map onto that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm torn on this advice. Like in some, it's like, yes, moving across the country might not help, but also like, it feels very like, if you want to stop feeling this way is the advice that I felt was the most like, that's such out there, maybe 90s advice of like, just stop feeling sad, you know, you'll be fine. Yeah.
But I did think that there was something to what her mom was saying here, which is that like, just moving, like just changing the place that you're at is not going to fix your problems. If there's something that you need to work through, like you're going to have to confront it. You can't just like run away from it. And that's not going to, like, you know, and obviously we also get the impression that her mom wants her to stay, like for her own reasons. But I do think that there's something about like, you know, just showing up in Orlando is not going to make the things that happened to you not have happened to you.
Yeah, for sure. It all does make me think that, you know, I'm watching this episode with kind of a, we don't really understand when any of these scenes are happening. And even the ones that seem sort of sequential could not be. It just makes me like, as we're watching this, think like, okay, is there, you know, who knows what Ginny's timeline is? Who knows what, you know, the timeline that we're seeing even within Kirby, like, is it all happening in the order that we're seeing it? Yeah, I have a lot of like time questions.
I was wondering the same thing with Ginny. The only thing I have from Ginny's storyline is that like the computers are a little old, but that doesn't mean it has to be 1992. Like this could be 2003 computers, you know, so it could be, you know, some point in the middle.
Never enough funding for science.
That's
so
true. I think, again, I'm going to reference Severance. Remember you and Amanda saying this, like at some point the show, I remember like we were talking about theories, like the shows need to establish a baseline at some point, but I don't think the show has established a baseline yet for like what can they pull the rug out from under us and us be like, okay, yeah, that works, or no, that doesn't really work. We don't know. I think your point was like about like, what can we actually trust? There needs to be
right,
we need to trust something.
Yeah.
We need to trust something. And I don't know that we know what we can trust yet, especially with a fairly unreliable, you know, main character.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that great scene, like in a coming up in a couple of scenes in the news room. Actually, it's like,
and this is it. Yeah.
We're right. Yeah, this is it. Where the editor is leading a meeting and asking about stories. And Dan says that the Julia story is going to be late because he's pursuing an alternate suspect. It could be a serial offender. You know, why does he think this? It's because he has a source. Well, is it a credible source? And Dan says, I don't know yet. And it's like, we don't know yet.
Yeah.
And the moment right before this, where Kirby's talking to him, and she says she knows what happened because it happened to her. And Dan says it's not enough. And she says it should be. And it, you know, like a bit of gut punch here around like your personal experience and anecdotal evidence. And, you know, like that should be enough. But obviously, like in the grander scheme of like proof and, you know, is it enough to understand what happened to Julia? Like Kirby feels like she knows, and that's a really kind of important bit for her. It felt like there was a lot of kind of nuance in that moment of it should be, which really stuck out to me.
No, I totally agree. And I remember thinking that, like, I mean, and I think that this again, like, speaks so poignantly to, you know, the experience of being a victim of one of these assaults. And we know from Kirby that she like actually can't trust anything about her reality. And she's like taking notes, and she knows this, that like there's so many things she can't trust. But what she can trust is that it's like she says about this, it's the only record I have, and it's the only one that matters. Like there's the one thing that she can trust is that she knows what happened to her. And the fact that like, to present that to people and to not be believed about that, like how invalidating that is, to take that one piece of reality that she can hold on to away from her. I do think that that was a really poignant moment.
And I think that, you know, I was looking when the book came out in 2013, and I was trying to map when did the Me Too movement happen. So the book
much
is kind
later.
Of
later.
Well, so the first instance of Me Too is from 2006. So it depends on how much the author, much the author has done their research. But I feel like publicly mainstream, it's like much more like 2015, 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. But now the show is coming out then, and they're choosing now to like adapt this book. The part earlier where I was talking about like how Dan has a domestic write up in his thing, and I'm a little bit worried about where that goes. This counterbalances a little bit in the sense that I do feel like a little bit of what they're saying here is like, believe women, is like what they're saying, that like women don't make up, you know, abuse allegations, that like that's a very hard, you know, the idea that you will immediately be discredited, that Dan is being like, it's kind of not enough for you to just like say that you've done it. I think it's a very powerful statement. And I think that, and her saying it should be, I think it's also a more powerful statement that I think I trust the show a little bit, that is where they are going to go with the story and choosing to tell this story now. So, yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting that you brought that up, Grace, because things have changed in such a short period of time. And I usually think of like October 2017, which was like the Harvey Weinstein allegations, as being like a big watershed moment that obviously like evolved over, you know, the next, you know, several years. And we're even in a different point, I would say, right now compared to then. So thinking about this as being a book that was published in 2013, and now obviously a television show that's being made in 2021, 22, like thinking about like, what are the differences between that and how the story is portrayed? Because there has been such a shift around this idea of, you know, believing women and what that means.
Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of. I don't know if the shift is as big as we want it to
be. Well, yeah, no, that's why I think like, and even now, like I do feel like there was, you know, like there was a high watermark for the Me Too movement, and then there was a backlash to the Me Too movement, and then there's like the backlash to the battle. So it's like a constant battle, right? To like to kind of grapple with these issues. And like some of it is you know, classic misogyny and sexism, and then like some of it is also like, you know, legitimate questions about legal process, like, which is also you know, valid. So
yeah So the last scene or scenes are sort of intermingled. So I'm just going to separate them out a little bit. We'll start with Ginny. Harper is watching her at some sort of like event at the planetarium. She gets somebody whispers in her ear. She heads to the telescope, emergency telescope situation.
Somebody gets her. It's like, you have to look. Like, there's something going on in space. It's wild.
Maybe this is a space show.
Is there an astronomer in the house? We have a space event.
So she runs to the telescope, she turns it, she moves it, and as it's sort of moving, we see Harper. He jumps at her and attacks her, and he does stab her, and that is where we leave Ginny and Harper at the end of episode one.
Yeah, there's a lot of blood. It was really gross.
A lot of blood. Yeah. And you're talking about the coloring of the, this is very, it's very red hued.
And like,
so creepy too.
Yeah, I understand that, like, it's to help with the telescope, right? Like, it's, you know, the same way you have you know, that
a red light on your flashlight, right? Yeah.
Yeah, to like adjust to your dark vision, whatever.
Yeah.
But also obviously I think
creepy horror, like,
also creepy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then our alternate scene, Kirby is walking home. She goes to apartment 2B, tries her keys, they do not work, so she knocks on the door. This man answers and it's like, wrong apartment. He's like, but this is 2B. Yeah, I know. And he shuts the door on her, and she looks at her license. So she lives in 3B. So she heads upstairs. The keys work. Grendel is a cat again.
A different cat, I think.
A different cat, maybe. Yeah,
that's cat.
Okay. I didn't notice that, but yeah.
I think it's a black cat, and earlier it's an orange and white cat.
But... so it's not a copycat. How many times can I make Amanda Melissa groan on this podcast? You'll find out. Keep track at home. He's like, oh, thank God you're here. And then Marcus is in the apartment.
Yeah, she lives with Marcus. She lives with Marcus. And he comes, as are you all right, gives her a hug, and she's like, okay, I'm obviously, like, I'm living with this person. And he asks, you know, what happens? She's like, it's nothing. I just came home. And then while they're embracing, she just looks like completely panic stricken.
Elizabeth Moss face acting. Mm-hmm. That's what she's good at. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The song that's playing in the scene is one that I really like. It's Alone Again or by Love. And this song is like featured in the Wes Anderson film Bottle Rocket, which is one of my favorites. So I enjoyed that. I was trying to look up all the music because I thought that there were good music choices across the board in this show, but I wanted to call that one out.
Alone Again. That's because, like, she's not alone, but she's alone in the idea that nobody else can see what she's seeing, right? So
And one of the lines is in this song is something about like that I could be in love with almost everyone, and it's like there's just something about like it's like about like not like there's like not a specificity to these feelings, and I thought that was interesting because like she's kind of doesn't know what her relationship is with anyone or anybody. So and that's our episode one.
Yes. I'm excited to dive in more. I think there's enough there to keep me hooked. I think the acting is tremendous, and there's sort of enough story here to keep me interested. So
I need to figure out what WTF is going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
With this.
Yes. So they did drop three episodes at once. We will have podcast coverage of each of the three episodes. This is obviously episode one. And over the course of the weekend, maybe into early next week, we'll have episodes 2 and 3. And then we'll be back in your feeds weekly on Fridays. I believe this podcast will drop in the Binge Show recaps feed. It's where we're storing all of our stuff that's non-HBO, and then also in the regular feed. It is almost the beginning of the month, so I would recommend, if you're interested in becoming a patron, there's a wonderful patron community where you get lots of bonus content, including Melissa currently covering Harry Potter over on YA with Brooklyn Zed and Kevin Mahadeo. Great coverage. Super loaded Harry Potter coverage, book coverage and movie coverage and feedback coverage. It's great.
It's going long. That's okay if people are into it. If you're not, we've covered a lot of other stuff like Twilight and Hunger Games and lots of, you know, the Mighty Ducks Game Changers show. So
yes,
if any of that is of interest, there's a lot of other stuff on the Patreon, as well as, you know, Kevin and Josh do Extra, their podcast that's talking about, I think it's Daredevil right now.
Yep,
I don't know Kevin's podcast.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's okay. He doesn't listen to yours.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's on Extra. They're currently covering season 3 of Daredevil. There's some movie club content over in the Patreon feed. And yeah, a whole lot more. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. As I said, you'll get billed at the beginning of the month. So I might wait till the beginning of May to become a patron. Josh is going to watch all 3 Star Wars movies the first 3 Mondays. Not all Star Wars movies, the original trilogy, the first 2 weeks in May. May the 4th be with you. We're not watching it on May 4th. We're watching it May 2nd, May 9th, and May 16th,
May,
I believe.
May the 2nd, 9th, and 15th be with you.
Yeah, yeah, they're the Mondays in May. So Josh and Philly will be watching those. Melissa, anything else going on? Where can people find you?
Sure, yeah. Follow me on Twitter, as long as that's the thing people do, at MelissaW28. And otherwise, I'm playing Dungeons & Dragons over on twitch.tv/dmphilly with Grace, at the Dragonfly D&D in Space show on Tuesdays. We also do Humble Year, which is like cute woodland animals playing D&D on some Fridays. You can check out old episodes on search DM Philly on YouTube, and you'll find it. So yeah, if you think that Grace and I are entertaining as people, like, you know, check us out in our alternate forms.
Amanda, what about you?
I will be persisting in my human form, and you can find me on Twitter, where I am Dr. Amanda R. That's Dr. Amanda R. And I'm really looking forward to joining you, Grace, and Ariel, and Marissa to talk about the season 2 of Russian Doll, which we're going to be doing on Monday.
Yeah, if you have a feedback for, if you've watched all of season 2 of Russian Doll, send us your feedback either in the Discord, on Twitter, or grace@postshowrecaps.com, and we will chat through all your theories and thoughts of season 2 of Russian Doll. It was a wild one. It was fun. Emotional.
Yeah. If you're like, I want more talk about trauma.
Yeah, for real. Intergenerational trauma.
And alternate timelines. Yes.
I'm on Twitter at @HiFromGrace. Lots of things to plug, but I won't bore everybody with all of them. Follow me on Twitter at @HiFromGrace. We'll be back in a few days' time with episode 2 coverage of The Shining Girls. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.